You're listening to an Iconic exclusive, which is an interview that we do with one of the industry designers or participators with 13th Age. Due to the nature of the interview, this podcast may run a little bit longer than our normal episodes, as we're just going to let the person we're interviewing talk and answer our questions, and we're going to have a good time doing it. So just be warned, this one may run longer than what you're normally used to listening to.
This is Iconic, with your hosts JM, Mark, and Nick.
Welcome to Iconic, where we talk about all things 13th Age. I'm your host, JM, and with me tonight is Nick.
Hey.
Tonight we have a special exclusive for you, an interview with 13th Age author Gareth Ryder Hanrahan.
Iconic exclusive.
Well, Gareth, welcome to Iconic. Thank you so much for being on here. For those of you who don't know, Gareth is the author of Make Your Own Luck, which was the free RPG day 13th Age adventure, as well as the upcoming Eyes of the Stone Thief dungeon and the Book of Loot. Again, Gareth, welcome.
Good morning.
For all of those of you listening to this, it is 10 o'clock at night in Colorado where we are recording, which makes it 5 a.m. for Gareth. So he is a man dedicated to the 13th Age.
Indeed.
So,
or a man who... go on.
No, go ahead.
Or a man who stepped through his alarm clock. So,
well, Gareth, how did you get into gaming originally?
I wandered into the city library when I was about 12 years old at a Tolkien book week, being a huge fan of Tolkien, and there was a large group of people standing around a table shouting, and I went, "What on earth is that?" And wandered over, and there was this group running a demo game of Middle-earth role-playing. And they sort of plucked me out of the crowd, gave me a character, which was an elf who'd gone through Moria. And I went, "This is the coolest thing ever." And then went off and tried to find the same game and spent a year trying to work out how a ridiculously complicated Middle-earth war game I found in a bookstore could be the game I was playing in the library. And then finally I found a copy of Redbox D&D and it all fell into place.
Excellent. I played Middle-earth role-playing. It might have been the first role-playing book that I purchased off the internet. Got it on eBay, I think. It's a good game. It was a good one to introduce a Tolkien fan to, obviously.
Oh, it was exactly the right entry vector.
So how did you make the transition from playing games to designing them?
I was, and still am, very much involved with the Irish convention scene, writing convention scenarios. And this was back in the late 90s when the internet was sort of first becoming popular, so I was throwing things up on the internet. And I sort of parlayed writing convention scenarios into getting a few freelancing gigs. Then I was working in an incredibly boring computer firm and got downsized and gave myself 3 months to sort of try writing as a career. And that was... at this point, a terrifyingly long time ago, like 11 years. So,
oh wow,
so, yeah, largely by accident, effectively. that was basically. I am still on my 3 month. Sure, I'll give it a go and see if this works.
Well done.
Indeed. Yeah, I was going to ask if how that 3 months went.
Well, 11 years later.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
The proof is in the pudding, as they say.
So, indeed. What brought you into 13th Age?
Pelgrane, basically. I'd done quite a lot of freelance work for Pelgrane over the last couple of years and came on board as a sort of semi-part-time or semi-full-time, whatever, semi-permanent is the word I'm looking for. Again, it's 5 a.m. here. A few months ago, just as sort of 13th Age was spinning up, and I had quite a bit of D20 or F20 experience already, so it was a natural fit that I leap onto that as it was getting going.
So how long has that been?
I think I've been with Pelgrane for nearly, as a starfighter for nearly a year now. And I'd pitched Eyes of the Stone Thief as soon as, almost as they announced 13th Age, right in that when he started, again, about a year ago. So yeah, about a year of really sort of focused 13th Age involvement.
Awesome. So what upcoming industry product, 13th Age or just general role-playing wise, are you most excited about right now?
I have made a list here of myself. Of stuff I'm utterly uninvolved with, I'm really looking forward to Robin Laws's Cthulhu project, The Dreamhounds of Paris, which is you're all playing surrealist painters who've managed to invade the Dreamlands in Call of Cthulhu or Trail of Cthulhu.
Oh, that'll be fantastic.
I've been sort of deliberately staying away from reading too much about it because I want to just grab the book and probably try and run it. I'm looking forward to Will Hindmarch's Project Dark, which is you're all playing thieves in a fantasy city.
Okay.
And it's not upcoming, but recently out. Have you seen, I think his name is Jason Saltis' Dungeon Dozen website?
I have not.
No, I haven't either.
It's a fantastic site. He basically, every day, he does this D12 table of fantastically surreal fantasy stuff.
He
brought this compilation of lists there a few weeks ago, which has been sort of clamped to my 13 Age rulebook for a while because it's very handy, sort of quick reference for ideas.
Well, we'll get the link for that and put that in the show notes. That is a really good point.
They're the sort of things that, like leap to mind immediately.
So tell us a little bit, what are you currently playing at the table? Or do you have time to play at the table with all your writing?
I do, although I had my wife and I had twins there like 17 months ago, so gaming has also slowed down because of those.
Congratulations.
Yeah, I know how that goes.
Indeed.
My daughter was just born last week, so I'm pretty much checked out of gaming for a while.
I sort of felt I sort of keep my claws in just for professional reasons, if nothing else. And also sanity. My main thing actually is playing a ongoing playtest of Eyes of the Stone Thief, which has been going on for like 9 months or so at this point. And I'm also running a couple of playtests of other upcoming games. So yeah, a lot... When you're writing it, a lot of your games turn into playtests and your players become very long-suffering with, right guys, we're changing everything this week. Here are new characters. Here's the new setting. Off you go.
Is it hard when you're playing a game that you're actively working on to keep that, you know, the enjoyment side of it separated from the work side of it?
It can be. You sort of, you end up, you sort of remind yourself it's supposed to be fun. So it's a hard way of putting it, but you can be very, very focused on does this work, mm-hmm. is this enjoyable for the players, and forget to actually enjoy it yourself. Fortunately, with the Eyes of the Stone Thief setup, how the campaign works, we'll get on to that in a few minutes anyway, is that it's very, very modular. You run a bit of the campaign, run a bit of your own stuff, a bit more of the published material from the book. Mm-hmm. It's designed to sort of be weaved in and out of your own material. So whenever I get sort of, whenever I want to be more spontaneous and improvised and get away from running my own stuff, I can just have the dungeons sink back into the ground and they get back into, at this point, overthrowing the priestess.
Oh, nice. Well, let's get a little bit deeper into some of the stuff you're working on. How do you go about coming up with an adventure for 13th Age for publication? How did you pitch The Stone Thief?
I pitched Stone Thief as it's Moby Dick. Only Moby Dick is a dungeon. That basically, there is this vast living dungeon that people are obsessed with killing. And it's going around marauding through the land and the players have to hunt it down and kill it.
I think I just got a little bit more excited about the product.
Well,
that's awesome.
You should know that that makes a lot more sense to me as well. My gaming group, of which Nick is a part of, we got to participate in One of the initial playtests for Eyes of the Stone Thief, we playtested the Sunken Sea.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm continuing to run parts of it, and it makes a lot of sense. It just brings it all in perspective.
Yeah, it actually worked very well as a structure. It's gone slightly away from the Moby Dick theme as it's developed. Basically, how the book is going to be divided into two sections. There's basically the write-up of the dungeon itself, with, of course, 13 levels. And then there's another section on basically using it in your campaign and what we've termed sort of surface quests. And the idea is that there is this ancient and evil living dungeon, the Stone Thief, which is the habit of basically rising up. Unlike normal living dungeons, it rises up, grabs bits of the surface, sucks them down, so it goes up, eats a city or a castle or a smaller dungeon. Or, as happens in the campaign, whatever your player characters love and cherish. So if you've spent like the last two levels building up your stronghold on the edge of the Elven Lands or whatever, one day this dungeon goes, yob! eats your castle, sinks back down, carrying away your, you know, all your stuff, and, you know, family, loved ones, pet dog, and you have to go off and chase it down. And find a way to actually kill a, you know, giant living dungeon.
I've got to say, I love the idea of the dungeon not only being the villain of the campaign, but actively hunting the players as they hunt for him, or her, as it may be. Because the dwarves, I don't think you've read that part, but the dwarves always refer to the Stone Thief as a she.
And actually, one very interesting thing is that because it's a mobile living dungeon, you can have your dungeon crawl, go anywhere else in the realm, and then have the dungeon crawl crop up again as Stone Thief hunts the player characters. It's like my group have been attacked by it like three times so far. And like the first time was like on the edges of Santa Cora, head off the Red Wastes, here comes the dungeon again. And now they've like flown way up north into the Dwarflands, but it's still after them.
Well, it seems like it might make sense as a player just to sit tight and wait for it to come.
That's one option, but you have to leave the dungeon to find ways to kill it, because it's not just a question of getting all the way down and stabbing it in the heart, because that heart is blocked off.
So the player will need to take multiple quests into the dungeon?
That's the idea. It's just the structure. You go in about like three or four times, and by the end of it, the dungeon's running away from you. You're going, these people have the tools to kill me.
I'm really looking forward to this. I'm not going to lie.
Well, let's just do you know when Eyes of the Stone Thief is going to be available?
It'll be this year, is the what we can promise.
Not a Gen Con release, though.
It won't be a Gen Con. Will unfortunately not happen. We're still doing final playtesting tweaks. The cartography, which is being done by this guy called Herwin, and it is... there's some samples up on the Pelgrim site. It's exquisite sort of isometric view of the dungeons. It looks all 3D. It's really, really gorgeous.
We're not going to get those lovely sketches as framed pieces of art.
I want some of those there. And some of the artists come in. We've got a lovely piece by Russ Nicholson. He's this old school artist and stuff for Games Workshop and people back in the 80s.
Oh, okay.
And it's shot of the dungeon sort of rising up on the ground, breaching like a whale. It's gorgeous.
Well, you all have done a really good job whetting our appetite with the free RPG day adventure. Make your own luck, as it serves as a tie-in to the Eyes of the Stone Thief. So, question for you: you know, aside from the obvious marketing motivations behind it, what was the impetus behind doing a prelude adventure?
Basically, I just took a section of my own campaign and wrote it up, because in my group had also been doing the whole town under siege that gets interrupted by the dungeon. So that worked rather well. I can just remove my player characters, bring it down a couple of levels, and off we go. So yeah, it was basically sort of, it sort of arose from play fairly fairly naturally. So it came pre-playtested, in fact.
Fantastic. Well, I ran that 2 weeks ago for my group. I introduced them to 13th Age with just two parts of Wrath of the Orc King or Wrath of the Orc Lord. And they were like, this game's awesome. We're ready to play. And then they played Make Your Own Luck, and Marrow Breath ate them. I had two players die. The Necromancer and the
Necromancers are very, very fragile. They're supposed to die.
They are, but the Sorcerer as well. So they made me promise to say, why was Marrow Breath so tough? They also gave him a magic greatsword when they were
he's sort of, because it's their fault. They're the ones who were saying, oh, that troll thief, he's a magic greatsword. Mm-hmm. I've heard that Marrow Breath kills player characters.
That's right. GMs don't kill players. Players kill players.
Exactly.
So we interviewed Rob about 2 weeks ago, and he mentioned you were working on the Book of Loot. Nick and I both heard the Book of Luke and were really interested. And then we're still very interested about the Book of Loot. What can you tell us about? Can you give us any insights, any hints onto what the book will contain?
The Book of Loot is a compendium of magic items and treasures for 13th Age. It's got about, 200 or so magic items in it, divided by icons. So you've basically got a chapter of Archmage items, chapter of Diabolist, chapter of Crusader, and so forth, as well as a couple of new one-shots, potions and scrolls and oils, and a discussion of basically mundane treasure and how to make it fun.
Okay.
Basically, it's cool stuff you find in the dungeon.
Well, earlier this week, there was a post up on Pelgrane's website of a fantastic piece of loot that was cut from the book. I think it was a magical chessboard that gave the players additional powers if they turned in the pieces.
And the chessboard of the ages.
Yeah, that's it. So I read that and I was like, this is awesome. So it got my my interest piqued as far as if this was cut from the book, what sort of awesome things are going to be included in the book? Tell us a little bit how you decide what to keep and what to get rid of.
Once I had the initial draft done, it went over to Rob Heinsu for review. And then we sort of like, it went back and forth. We ended up finally sending in the 13th version of the book, which was, I felt, was rather nice. Basically, items got cut because they were too complicated. I mean, the chessboard, for example, would take up like a page almost of text, and that would have still left us open to endless questions on the forums.
Well, I suppose that even after the book is released, because that's been posted on the website, GMs could still take that and use that as a piece of loot in their adventure.
Oh, yeah, of course.
I like that you're organizing them by icons. That'll make using them as a relationship from relationship roles a lot easier.
I'm actually really don't like using icon relationships to give magic items too much.
Oh, okay.
The main reason I organized them by icon was more for thematic reasons, that you can go like, I want to drop in a Diabolist item because we're in a Diabolist dungeon or whatever, I'll go to that chapter.
Oh. So how do you
I always feel that giving away items with relationship rules on the early couple levels, it trains the players to feel, I get six, I deserve an item.
That's a good point.
Whereas I feel there are much more interesting things to do with icon rules than just hand out items unless you actually need to sort of like, rebalance the party or whatever.
Well, let me ask you this. How do you tend to use icon relationships in your game? Because that's one of the hot topics on the Google Plus community right now.
At this point, my sort of current policy is players rule at the start of the session. I note down who gets what. If I have sort of an immediate idea, based on the current situation for an icon result, I'll say, the Elf Queen contacts you and says, by the way, I have this group of soldiers near Santa Cora, where the campaign's based. They're at your disposal for the session if you need them. But more often, I'll just say, you have that icon benefit. If an opportunity comes up to spend it, where you want to draw on it, let me know. So, because of my campaign, a lot of it is currently politicking and jockeying for power in Santa Cora, often the players would go, right, can I convince the Wizards Guild to build a temple to the non-existent god of magic? I have this chip from the Archmage here. Can I call in that favor? Hmm. Or they'll just sort of go, I just messed up that rule. The dragon's going to eat me. Can I use my relationship with the three to somehow get out of this? Where, in that case, the player generally sort of flashes the secret sign saying, I am a secret spy for the three. And the dragon winks at him and goes, ah, I will not eat you.
I really feel like Pellegrine could put out a whole book on icon relationships, or at least a very intense PDF, because it feels like there are a number of different ways to interpret them and use them and have them drive the game for you.
I'm sure that there's definitely going to be more stuff on icons in the future. I have many strong opinions, many of which are utterly incompatible with each other on how best to use them.
Well, going back to the Book of Loot, could you give us a teaser or a preview of one of the items that made it into the book?
I'm very, very fond of just for sort of the marriage of rules and concept of this thing called the Code Book of Nefarious Machinations. One of my favorite bits of 13th Age is the rule of you can flee in combat whenever you want, which takes campaign loss, because it sort of marries the whole old school idea of you can throw any monster at the player characters. The world isn't sort of neatly divided by you will always meet level appropriate orcs.
Right, concentric that sort circles of difficulty.
Yeah. But at the same time, you can have nicely balanced tactical encounters, because if the encounter isn't tactically balanced, the players can run away without you need to worry about, can they escape? Yes, they always escape. Oh, they'll always escape, but something bad will happen to them as a result of them fleeing combat. The code book, how it works, is whenever your group takes campaign loss, you get a temporary one-point relationship with the Prince of Shadows.
Okay.
And when you finally get a 5 or 6 and call that and get the benefit of that, you must then explain how your earlier loss was all part of the prince's plan and how you've helped him put forward his advance his goals and are now getting your payoff.
That is amazing. That is a great item.
It sort of softens the edge of having to run away, drags the players into the web of the prince's machinations, and it just feels cute. So I'm a big fan of that.
Well, and as a player, it might almost make you want to flee, just so you can see how that plays out.
Indeed. And of course, now you're going to be mistrusting your fellow players, going, is he
supposed
to run away because we can't win this fight, or because it's all part of the prince's evil plan?
And I do love that kind of paranoia to be injected into my games, so well done.
Not at all. Actually, I did a lot of writing for the paranoia role-playing game back in the day, and there's an odd crossover between paranoia and 13th Age in a lot of ways. When you're doing adventure design, for example, for a 30th Age game, one thing they look for is basically ways to use for all the icons to fit in. Mm-hmm. So you can, if a player is heavily invested in something obscure like the Orc Lord or the Three, so right, why would the Three be interested in this? In saving the small village in the middle of nowhere? Why would the Orc Lord have influence here? Why would the Archmage, and I'm paranoid about secret societies, mm-hmm. have been sort of brought into every mission as well. So there's a similar sort of mindset when it comes to initial adventure design between the two games. Plus terrible puns.
Plus terrible puns, yes. So when can we expect Book of Loot? Is that a next year project?
It should be at Gen Con.
Awesome.
Everything is done. We're really up to the vagaries of printers at this point. But Chris Huth did a heroic job doing layout at the last minute, so it should be there.
Well, I will look for it. So are you going to be at Gen Con?
I am.
Excellent. Well, we'll have to go out and grab a cup of coffee or grab a beer or something.
Or tea.
Definitely.
Or tea. That's right.
I shall bring proper tea.
I look forward to it.
So stepping back a little bit from the products you've been working on, just to kind of look at 13th Age in general, what would you say is your favorite mechanic of 13th Age?
I shall be dull and go for the escalation die, just because the escalation die is one of those ideas that goes, hang on, why weren't we doing that all along? That makes perfect sense. Because I've played so many dungeon crawl games where the outcome of the fight has been blatantly obvious from like your round three. Mm-hmm. We still have to grind through hit points on the dragon or whatever. You know you're going to win. The only question is how many resources you're going to use doing it, mm-hmm. or will there be a lucky roll? Just speed you up combat and also give you a very nice sort of pacing mechanic. So you can see the fight is going this way. or the fight's gone this long, new powers can kick in. It just all works very, very well. The other thing I love about it is that there's something physical on the table that's changing. And because we don't have miniatures, and also my current setup wouldn't suit miniatures given the way we play, it's nice to have this sort of physical object on the table that drags the player's attention back to the center of the room at the start of every round. The escalation is escalating. Thump. Everyone goes, new round. Yay. I can do stuff again. It's the element of sort of ritual to escalating it that really does help the game focus.
Yeah, speaking of that, as a player, I definitely love seeing that die turn. And it's, the GM could just as easily say, okay, the escalation number is now X, plus 3. But to watch him grab that die, turn it around until the right number comes up and set it back down, you're right, it does kind of recenter the player's attention back on the game and what they're going to be doing.
Yeah, I think it really does have to be being just a ritual. Like, if I didn't have a physical dice, I was announcing the number, I think I would write it on a piece of paper and stick it on the wall or carry it around the announcers or the round announcers at a boxing match or something. Escalation dice 3!
Well, one thing I really liked about Make Your Own Luck was that you were using the escalation die as a event timer as well, where when the stone thief is coming up, on this round, the cracks open up, and then on this escalation die, something else happened. And after those two PCs dropped, and the paladin was also unconscious, I think I had who is still up? I had a rogue. And the cleric, was out of healing, and that die kicked to 6.
Guilt.
Yeah. Well, the die kicked to 6, and spoiler alert, I am going to spoil part of the Make Your Own Luck. When it got to 6, the Imperial Dragon shows up and just destroys the Marrow Breath, the troll. It does X number of damage, and the troll happened to be below that, so it ended it. And they were so relieved. But I liked the idea that the encounter die, or the escalation die, what could be used as a counter during the game.
Yeah, in Stone Thief, there are a lot of traps which are basically tied to the escalation die. You enter the room, when it hits 1, the floor starts shaking. When it hits 3, it cracks open, and the two halves would start sliding apart. You see there's a lake of lava in the middle of the room. Escalation die 6, you're swimming in lava. How's your fire resistance? Actually, when we were playtesting, it was pointed out that, hang on, you can't, should we be using the escalation die as a sort of physical timing mechanism? Because there are all sorts of powers that will mess the escalation die, humans can accelerate it and so forth. And we said, yeah, it still makes sense. It's still sort of an excitement timer.
Oh,
so
yeah.
If the players do hurl themselves forward and escalate the die sooner than is normal, then the trap will still go off sooner than normal. Add to the fun and confusion. And the other great thing about it, because there are many great things about the escalation die, is I love monsters that steal it or mess with it, just because it's such a sort of violation of the player's space. Hang on, that's our stuff. You can't take our dice.
I think, was it the Sahagwin in the Sunken Sea area that were completely, the whole encounter with the Sahagwin King, the escalation die is being pulled back and forth, and the players did not like that at all.
It strikes something very, very deep in the player when you take their dice. The monster is touching my dice.
Yes.
He's not allowed to touch my dice.
No touch.
Exactly.
Well, speaking about monsters, what's your... I know 13th Age draws on a rich history of D20 monsters. What's kind of your favorite iteration of the monster in 13th Age?
I've got an awful lot of use of... liches in every single game I run, especially 13th Age, just because they're great fun to play. I really love the red caps. I mean, they're a very sort of strong flavor monster with their, you know, the red cap power is the bad word.
Yes.
that's like you couldn't run a campaign around them because the players would strangle you deservedly.
Yes. I think Rob mentioned that as one of his favorites as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, it's a very sort of interesting monster because it breaks the sort of assumed structure of how you play.
Yes.
Which is shocking to the players, but shocking is good because it's just like, hang on, refocus. This monster does not behave as... This monster does not stay neatly contained on the page over there. It's climbing into my mouth and stealing my words and beating me up with them.
Nick has been on the receiving end of a red cap attack.
Indeed.
Yeah.
The one I've got the most use of lately is the Hag from the Bestiary. She's one of the few, like, 13th Age monsters which has the huge long list of abilities because of all these different sort of flavors of Hag.
Right.
And basically, there's a major Hag NPC in Eyes of the Stone Thief, which the players ran into, and she's become fairly central to the game and resulted in our first player near death, or character near death. When she went up to the players and went, "Hello, I am evil, but we have we have goals in common. I will help you, you will help me. We will ignore our obvious alignment differences." And the three-quarters of the player group went, "Yes, that seems plausible." And the paladin just went, "No, I cannot work with someone evil." And she went, "Fair enough." And there was a slight level of discontinuity in that she was, like, you know, four levels higher than the paladin, and wiped the floor with him and handed his bloody corpse over to the players and went, "Right, now that little awkwardness is out of the way, do we still have a deal?" To which they went, "Yeah, sure, yeah, no, we're good with that."
Well, other than Eyes of the Stone Thief and Book of Loot, what's on the horizon for you with 13th Age? What will you be working on? What are you excited about?
Book of Loot is only just off my plate, given there was a race at the end to get it ready for Gen Con, and there was a lot of back and forth. So now I'm going from 13th Age back off to Trail of Cthulhu for a few months, or Trail of Cthulhu to Night's Black Agents for the Dracula dossier. Night's Black Agents is this game where you're playing spies versus vampires, and the Dracula dossier is you find the annotated original version of Dracula, which described how British intelligence tried to recruit him in 1894 and totally messed it up, and you've got to go and investigate what really happened. But my next 13th involvement will be with the upcoming, I think still unnamed, 13th Age annual, where we'll be doing a monthly short supplement. Rob's talked about this, sort of following on from 13 True Ways, where basically any bits that didn't make it, 13 True Ways will come out as like PDFs from the Pellegrine site. I'll definitely be doing a few of those. I'm not quite sure which ones yet. And I've also sent a list of, like, you know, 13 ideas for more supplements into Rob, and he's going to go through those. And we'll sit down at Gen Con and plan out what's next for me with 13th Age. So the answer is I don't know, but there are lots of ideas floating around.
Fantastic.
Well, I know based on just what I've read with Make Your Own Luck and what I've heard and experienced a little bit in playtesting with Eyes of the Stone Thief, I'm looking forward to your next involvement, whatever that may be.
Thank you. It's been wonderfully fun so far, even if Stone Thief did run on slightly longer than planned. Because I originally pitched it as a 160-page book. It's going to come out, if we're lucky, just short of 400.
Wow.
Well, like, the playtest document was way longer than that.
Yeah, well, layout does shrink things down a bit. But, yeah, I mean, the playtest document was, what, 500 pages, the one?
I think the one I got was somewhere between 3 and 4. But, yeah,
there's extra stuff that goes on the end, but yeah, it's a big dungeon. It's going to take you from basically level 4 well into level 7, probably level 8.
Nice.
And
well, let's hope that those added pages takes the Eyes of the Stone Thief from just being a good product to being a great product. we at the Iconic Podcast have kind of adopted the White Dragon as our mascot. And we asked Rob a little bit of information about him, and he basically said, you know what, we purposely didn't answer that question so that you can figure it out on your own. So I want to ask you, what's your take on who was White, and why did the Lich King kill him?
The answer to that is going to, like, you know, very much depend on what's going on in the campaign, what I need. If I was sort of starting fresh, and I wanted to bring the White Dragon in, then what I'd probably do is tie it to the seasons. That the White Dragon is the winter, and back when the Lich King was the Wizard King and a relatively good guy, he, like, you know, slew basically the Avatar of Winter, who was the White Dragon. And then I would tie the other dragon, the surviving dragons, the season. So you'd have basically the blue is what's. The green is spring, which makes sense. The elves would sort of, like, you know, have trapped spring, and now you've got eternal springtime in the elf kingdom. You've got, like, eternal summer over at Drakenhall, so you'd sort of describe it as the sort of sun drenched, sun baked, stones cracking under this never ending sunlight. And you'd have autumn for the black. And the red is the, I don't know, fifth season where everything burns. And basically, because the Lich King now has basically winter in his back pocket because he's killed and reanimated the dragon, at some point you'll have him basically return the proper flow of the seasons, and it'll be discovered that the whole Midland Sea is right basically at the North Pole of the planet and should be frozen solid if the Wizard King hadn't long ago driven back the cold by killing the dragon. Yeah, but do something sort of seasonal leading to the apocalypse.
See, that's the best one we've had so far. That's fantastic. And it also gives me a really good idea for my Song of Ice and Fire game. The White Dragon killed all the other dragons, and that's what's going on in George R. R. Martin's book. So I've just solved Ice and Fire, thanks to you, Gareth. I don't need to read the rest of the series. It's all the White Dragon and the Lich King.
Yeah, they've been behind it all along. Well, Lich King is in fact hot pie. wearing a mask of flesh.
Well, Gareth, thank you so much for coming on the show, and I look forward to, as it works out, you know, when Eyes of the Stone Thief releases, we'd love to have you back on and really dig into that product.
Certainly. So it's hopefully sometime this year, I've been ordered not to promise anything as regards dates.
That is fair.
Seems wise, indeed. As soon as is reasonable, basically.
Our group's really looking forward to it because we'll be listed in the playtest credits.
In very, very tiny print.
In very, very tiny print.
There were plenty of playtesters, which was very, very nice and all very, very useful. And only a few of them complained that I killed off their groups. Sorry. I always feel terribly guilty about that. I'd challenge you and hurt you, but not slaughter you. Sorry.
So as we close, is there any last comments you want to make?
No, I think just thank you very much for having me. I shall now go and properly wake up and hope I haven't said anything too foolish in my sleep-deprived state.
We plan to ransom this tape back to Wade.
That seems wise.
Well, you've been listening to the Iconic Podcast.
If you have any questions or comments, you can contact us at whitedragon@iconicpodcast.com or call and leave a voicemail at 720-924-1706.
And check out iconicpodcast.com for news, updates, and new episodes.
Thanks for listening.